Welcome to the chat reel with Billy and friends, standing in for Billy Tappin.
Get up, stand up,
oh,
stand up for your rights,
Lord, Lord.
Get up, stand up,
in the morning,
stand up for your rights.
Welcome to the chat reel with Billy and friends. Standing in for Billy Tappin, I introduce Dr. Denise Gotautis and Julie Sepulveda.
Thank you. I don't know what happened with that intro, but we had certainly a glitch. But I just thank everybody. I thank everybody for joining us for the program. We have a very, very special guest. I believe that there is some type of a technical delay that we are experiencing. I hope that everyone can hear me clearly. And today's guest, we're going to have Mrs. Renee Best. She is a retired teacher who spent 39 years in the classroom. But before we have our guest come on, I wanted to give a shout out to Julie. Julie, are you there? Hope, Julie, I hope there's in there in audience anyway, because I know that first of all, we're just going to start off with the program. We're going to start off with the music. Today, we're going to go in with Tom Brown, Funkin' for Jamaica, and Stevie Wonder, Higher Ground. We're going to go to a commercial right now while we figure out the glitches, of course, that we're having. I thank everybody for joining us here on the chat reel, and we're going to interview that fantastic guest of ours. We'll be right back after this.
Thank you.
It seems that we are having some delay with our technical system, but I would like to welcome everyone to the chat reel. And right now, as soon as we figure out this glitch, we were supposed to go to a song with Stevie Wonder with Higher Ground, but during a delay, can everybody hear me clearly?
I can hear you.
Can you hear me, please?
Oh, yes, I can. Yeah, for some unknown reason, our system is experiencing a delay. And I am happy, though, that Renee Best, she did join us. But with that, I would like to say that Renee Best, she is a retired teacher who spent 39 years in the classroom. She is familiar with school systems across the country. She has taught in Detroit, Michigan, Oakland, California, Newark, New Jersey, and finished her career in Florida. Renee Best spends her time in retirement writing. Her love of writing has yielded a nonfiction book, which is called Crazy in the Classroom. And this is about her experiences in inner city schools that she has. And she's also written a screenplay about a young Black woman who pursues a vicious street gang for killing her mother. Recently, she has completed a poetry book entitled Rapping Black Inventors, Poetry in Motion. And this book features 50 African American inventors. Renee is also an influencer on TikTok with over 21,000 followers. As a creator, her content is specifically designed for women of all colors as she addresses issues like being independent and self-sufficient. Renee loves sharing her experiences and her talents. And we just want to welcome her. And right now, me and Julie, we're standing in for Billy Tappan. He is on the mend, him and TJ, our DJ. But we're praying for their soon recovery, and we know that they will come back to the chat real soon, really soon. That's what we are really, really praying for. So without any further delay, we hope, and no more glitches we're praying for, I want to introduce Renee Best. Renee, I just really want to welcome you to the chat reel.
Thank you so much. I'm happy to be here. That introduction was very impressive. I'm like, who's she talking about? Thank you so much.
That was really. Billy has told myself. And Julie, he's told us so much about you, and we're excited just to hear your story and, you know, to hear about your book, Crazy in the Classroom.
Well, my
and Julie, you there, right?
Said,
I'm here. I'm here.
Can you hear me?
I hear you.
Yeah,
yes.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, my story started in 1978 when I did my student teaching in Detroit, Michigan. And I had about 15 boys jump my husband. So it was like, welcome to the inner city.
Oh, wow.
This is how we roll around here. And I'm just surprised that I didn't say at that point, you know, I'm out of here. I'm not going to do this anymore. But I think I'm a diehard, and I always wanted to be a teacher. And I found myself in these big cities as I moved around the country, and that's what I did. I taught. So I'm familiar with, like, schools in the north, the south, the east, the west coast. And it's kind of dire, you know, in our inner city schools. It's so dire, you know.
Yes.
The kids have such horrible behavior, but I feel so sorry for them. You know, because they are children and their behavior really
right.
reflects their environment and their experience.
Yes.
And I was at one school in Newark. We had over 150 gangs in that one school, and it was just a ninth grade school. And we had our own gang officer at the school. The problem was they made a mistake. This ninth grade school was a feeder school for 13 different elementary schools, which meant 13 different neighborhoods, which meant several gangs in each neighborhood. And they put they put all these kids in one school, and it was basically a war ground. You know, they were running gangs out of here. They were having fights and riots in front of the school, gangs fighting and stuff. Just poor behavior, but, I mean, just trying to survive,
Yeah, that's an experience. I mean, it makes me think, you know, when I think of school principals, you always go back to thinking about Joe Clark, Lean on Me. You know, the experiences of junior, you know, middle schools, which we call junior high schools and California school system. That's where I grew up and went to school. And, you know, and you always think of the challenges that, you know, children, they have, you know, with what you do. And, you know, it's just awesome, you know, to hear the stories of an educator. Now, you taught in Detroit. Which school system was the hardest for you? Was it Detroit, Oakland, California, Newark, New Jersey? Which one was the most challenging for you
They jumped my husband and, you know, kind of beat him up a little bit. But he was a linebacker for the University of Michigan. So when they jumped him in the school, he was okay, but he was, you know, he was just really angry. So that's what happened in Detroit for my student teaching my senior year. And then out in Oakland, they were off the chain. The parents were off the chain. I was threatened. I was locked in my room because a parent was coming to school with her gun to get me. And, you know, that kind of stuff happened in Oakland. And then we go to Newark, you know, and I got this 6'2" boy, 16-year-old in this school I was telling you about, trying to punch me in my face. So I don't know which school was the worst. When I got to Florida here, it was much better, you know, because the kids weren't so vicious. The kids aren't so vicious down here. It's the economy's different. Neighborhoods and communities aren't dense. So it was a lot better when I got down here, but I put my little 25 years in the battleground.
Yeah, you are a strong woman, that's for sure, because I know a lot of teachers, they will be like, okay, no, this is it. Because these days I'm noticing that a lot of principals, a lot of teachers in the classroom, they don't, as the years go by, it seems like they don't have that much capability when it comes to discipline the children to make them, you know, respect them and to behave. And I know that, you know, I don't know, during the years you were teaching, did you face those same challenges as trying to help a child but being unable to help the child? The children, you know, were able to, you know, do different things in the classroom and stuff that they shouldn't. I know this is our topic, but I'm kind of curious. Because, I noticed so much, Renee, that people, they are kind of, how can I put it? They're kind of, they don't care about the teachers. They care more about just have the harder job of teaching, and the principals, you know, have a harder time bringing discipline in the classroom these days. And these days they're like, okay, you do anything to me, you teacher, I'm going to act up and then I'm going to put you on my iPhone and show everybody what you're doing. But nobody ever really sees what the children that sometimes are disrupting the classrooms are doing. And I was wondering, have you had those challenges
the worst kids are the ones whose parent you call over and over and over again. And then after a while, you know, they first start, they try to work with you, but you're still calling home. And then after a while, they get mad at you, and now you're their enemy. And I've had to go through that so many times. I'm trying to help you with your child. you know, and then you're going to get mad at me. One lady told me, my daughter does not lie. And I thought to myself, girl, who are you kidding? You know your child better than I do, but you want to argue with me.
Right.
I think that was my biggest problem and the thing I'm most resentful about is that I didn't get the parental support that I needed to make an effect on every child. I made great effects on many children. I moved to Florida. I came back to Newark. I went to the mayor's picnic with a friend, and a child walked up to me. You know, Miss Bess, you were my teacher, and I don't recognize them all, especially the boys. And he told me, he said, I just graduated with my BA. I'm working for the mayor. I'm headed to law school because I want to write law journals because you taught me how to write, and I love it.
Oh, that wow. That's awesome when, that, you yeah.
Yeah,
when you make a difference.
Yeah.
When you make a difference in...
Yeah, yeah, I could have cried. I could have cried for sure, you know, because it was rough in Newark. It was very, very, very rough in Newark. I mean, the horror stories that I could tell you, you know, about trying to deal with these children, you know, who want to get
imagine.
In your face and want to attack teachers and rob our cars. And, you know, I had three girls that same year I was student teaching. They told me, don't stay after school. This was in Detroit where they jumped my husband. They said, don't stay after school. All the teachers leave when the bell rings. We all leave together. Don't stay. And I stayed after because I wanted to start a modeling club, and I just stayed after anyway. And I had three girls come into my room and approach me. They came in there to beat me up because I had given one of the girls a poor grade. And I was in the back
That's
of my
awful.
Room. My back was turned. And something told me to turn around. I turned around, and there was my student with two more girls. There were three of them. And I looked at them like,
oh,
I wonder what
goodness.
This is about. But when I looked at their faces, I could tell what this was about. So they had really come to beat me up. And you know, I have these eyes that kind of scare people. And I just basically looked at the three girls and told them, you three aren't enough. You need to go get some more friends because 1, 2, 3. That's not going to be fair. And they just turned around and left. But would I have fought those girls? Yes, I would have fought those girls, and I would have hurt those girls. And that's what I told them. If you don't leave, I'm going to hurt you. And I'm not playing with you, okay?
Teachers face so many temptations and challenges. Yeah. And see, I had a friend when I did Ariel's Torah talk. My friend Miriam, as a matter of fact, she was a teacher, and she would tell me those kids were doing in that classroom. But see, she taught at like a Jewish yeshiva. She taught at a Jewish school in New York, and that was something I would, you know, I would kind of like, you know, giggle. But I know that the children, they are doing what they see their parents do. And they're acting in the way they see their parents act. Because
that is so true. That is so true. It is.
Well, you know, the parents tell you, that teacher better leave you alone. That teacher better quit picking on you. I come up there and see that teacher. And then the kids get to school and they disrespect you because they know mom's willing to come up there. I mean, we've had parents come up there and basically try to jump teachers, quit in the school, get in the building, confront teachers, try to fight teachers, you know, and this is what makes me sad as a black woman, is that the only thing I believe is going to save us is education, and that's why I spent my life in the classroom. I could have been a principal, but I didn't want to leave the classroom because that was my thing, telling my children that education is the only thing that's going to pull you out of these projects, you know, up in Newark. So get your education, you know. And that's what I believe in. For parents not to be staunch about that concept and that principle, for you to not to understand that without an education, your kid is in the street. Well, obviously they don't understand because we got a lot of kids in the street.
Right.
So what are we
going to
do as parents? What are we going to do as parents? We need to start raising doctors, scientists, nurses, and not little gangbangers.
That's right. I agree. 100%. And, you know, I noticed that many people, they are depending upon schools, the schools to raise their children. They don't take the time when the children come home to make sure they're getting what they need as far as, you know, that time spent with them. So.
You know, they're busy. They're working. They got problems. You know, I understand parents are overwhelmed right now, but regardless
yes.
of that, your child has to be your priority. It has to be. You know, we got parents here that work two jobs just so they can buy kids, you know, designer tennis shoes. And I feel like this, you know, you need one job and spend the rest of the time with your kid. They don't need designer jeans. And down here in Florida,
that's
you
right.
know, I meet more privileged children than I've ever met in my career. You know, two parents in the house, big homes, designer clothes, but the parents are never there because they're working. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, most definitely. And, you know, that's a sad thing when the TV or the video game is the babysitter. Because it's a
it
lot
is.
Of things on that TV that kids shouldn't be watching. Hey, Julie,
well, you
I know
you
got a lot.
No, I do. I do.
I think those video games cause ADHD, you know, because, you know, the kid gets to school and they're so anxious and restless, they can't concentrate on school. Well, when you're on video games hours a day and you're being bombarded with the intensity of the interaction that you're going through, heck, when you go to school, it's going to be boring.
Right,
right.
It's supposed to be.
That's
supposed
just
to be
my theory. That's just my theory. That's just my theory.
But
and
you know what?
My...
I mean, I've heard of video games causing seizures and stuff in kids.
Ooh.
You know, I don't think you're far off because I can remember years ago they were saying that they are taking off some of these. Video games, it was a Chinese company. They made some Chinese video game, and they said the kids were staring in front of the screen, and one had a seizure. You guys haven't heard that one, huh?
No.
Well,
no, that's scary.
Yeah.
You know, there's a lot of things parents can do. And I think they should just pass a federal law where parents have to be participants and accountable for their child's education. In the fundamental
True.
Schools, the parents sign contracts to make so many meetings. They sign contracts to check homework. They sign contracts to get in a fundamental school. And I'm like, why can't we
right.
do that? Why can't we hold parents more accountable for their kids' education?
Right.
The schools didn't do all my education. My mother educated me. My mother taught me how to speak English,
yep.
you know, how to use good
grammar.
You know,
because that education, it starts from home, and people don't realize
yeah,
that.
My mom took us to the library once a month. You got all the books you wanted, and you went home and you read. Well, we only had three television stations, but I think even though my mom would have been like, you're going to spend time reading. And we spent time
right.
reading. You know, you got to educate your kid at home. Make them read. Make them write.
Yeah.
You know,
that's
get them
so
on
true.
The TV.
Yeah. And people don't do that. I mean, that TV babysitter is the wrong thing to do. I mean, parents get so busy, and then the teachers are left to deal with whatever the kids are learning off of the TV, you know.
Right.
No, TV should not educate the kids. It shouldn't be to where you're so busy working and you're doing stuff to where you can't even, you don't have time for kids. And it's ironic.
Right.
It's a sad reality. And then parents, after the kids grow up, they do something wrong, and they're like, no, my son, my daughter, they wouldn't do that.
Right. Right.
Right.
So,
yeah.
I mean, it's very, very, a very challenging, a demanding job. And you know what? I salute all the teachers out there because
right.
you especially, Renee. Yeah. Julie, you have any questions you wanted to ask Renee?
No, just to make the comment that a lot of what she's saying I can conglomerate with. My father in retirement, because of his education, did some secondary education, past retirement because he wasn't ready to work, and he said to me once, every time a child opens up their mouth, usually a lie comes out. So then you get these parents who come in there and say exactly what you were just saying. No, my child wouldn't do that. No, my child wouldn't do that. That's just natural for a teenager, or a pre-teenager to lie. And he said that's the biggest challenge that he faces is that the parents come in there. He has to call a student in there and they, we got to talk to your parents before you can come back into school again. And the parents come in very combative. They're angry, rather than when I was growing up, my dad had a theory. If you're in trouble at school, you're in trouble with me. I don't care who did what and who, if the teacher did this or another student did that. If you're in trouble with the teacher, you're in trouble with me. So fix it, And they just don't feel that way, Mike. He said that. And they come right in, and they're defending their child, and they don't even know the full story. And they, my child would never lie. You were just saying that. Not my child.
Yeah.
And it's just a whole different attitude. But then on the flip side of that, these kids today face a lot of challenges that we never faced growing up. They get up and go to school every day and wonder if they're going to get shot. There's going to be a mass killing. If somebody's going to beat them up because they're wearing the wrong color. Those were challenges that we didn't face growing up. So, school is a little bit tougher. I'll give the kids that for that. But if there's not anything interesting at school or something that's driving them to be there, they don't want to be there. They just don't want to. And you can see it in their attitude. You can see it in their homework. You can see it in how they talk to you.
And that's the truth.
They also reflect the community that they're coming out of, too. If they're coming out of a rough environment, where there's a lot of gangs in the neighborhood and, you can't walk home and so it's not only things happening in the school, but they happen in the neighborhood. The school I taught at in Newark, we had a grown man was shot right down the corner where the store was, not during school, but just a lot of, crime and the teacher's cars always got broke into. So when you bring these children into this type of world, into that type of community, they survive. Mad at them for joining. I can't be mad at them for being in a gang. I know so much about the gangs and being in a gang and why you're in a gang. If these neighborhoods weren't so doggone dangerous, these kids wouldn't have to be in gangs.
They are part of the gang.
It is survival the same time. But it makes them vicious and they come into the schools and, one of my problems, what was the worst school? In Newark, the school I was at, the ninth grade school, I had a secret compartment in my teacher's desk. If I pulled my desk out real far, you could see past the back of it and I had a secret drawer. I put weapons in that drawer every year, and at the end of every year, I would take those weapons out, and I did this every year. I had an ice pick, screwdriver, hammer, box cutter, switchblade, all kinds of stuff. I had a student walk into my room, and he had something long down his pants, and it scared the bejesus out of me. And I grabbed him and took him into the teacher's lounge and into the bathroom, one stall bathroom.
Uh-huh.
And I said, Juan, what do you have down your leg? Now, I thought it was a shotgun.
Of course.
I said, Juan, what do you have down your leg? And Juan was mumbling. I said, no, let's not play. Pull it out. I want to see what you got. He had a pipe that was probably about 2, maybe 2.5 feet long that he had brought to school. And the funny thing about it is it's the scary kids that bring the weapons. It's not the bullies that bring the weapons. It's the scary kids. And I said, Juan, what happened? He's like, well, so-and-so and them are after me. And so I brought this pipe to school, to protect
myself.
The kids
that are bullied. Yeah,
and,
the kids that are bullied are the ones like that. Wow.
And the pipe was way too big to put in my secret drawer. I ran to the bathroom one day. I wasn't even gone 2 minutes, I come back and I got a little girl chasing a boy around my classroom with a steak knife. And I mean, he's running, she's chasing, and the kids are laughing.
Oh no!
And I walk
in. They're entertained by that. Kids, they're entertained by all that violence.
And you can't be scared, and you can't panic, and you can't show any of this, you know. So I walk in, and I was like, Kelly, what are you doing? And I said, I'm going to tell your mama, you know, took her one of her good steak knives out the kitchen. You know, and everybody started laughing.
Yeah.
And then the kid said, well, she mad because Terrence won't go with her. And anyway, I got the knife from her.
Oh, my gosh.
You know, but I'm just a lot of weapons. And it's the scary kids that bring them. It is.
And it's really way too bad. I mean, you think that you were in some type of a prison or something, you know? I mean, how the prison guards have to get the weapons from a kid, you know? What environments, you're right, what environments are these kids coming from to make them react in the way that they do? And you're right, it starts with at home. It starts with the community itself. What are these kids being taught? What's being brought around them when they go home? They bring it all to the school, all to the teacher, all around the kids, you know. So, wow. I wanted to ask you, Renee, about the book you wrote, Crazy in the Classroom.
I mean, I just had so many crazy stories. Everybody kept saying, write a book. You know, and then finally in 2012, I published the book. But it's like I couldn't advertise it. I couldn't tell anybody about it because I was still teaching. And there's things that I had to do. There's things that I had to do in that book and say in that book that I felt like if it got out, I would get fired, and I probably would have. So I'm just now, really, since I retired, start kind of advertising and talking about my book because, I mean, I've cursed at kids. You know, the boy that tried to sock me in my face, I beat him up pretty bad. And, there's just things I can't, you know, I couldn't say when I was working.
You couldn't say. Oh, okay. It's your real
experience. Yeah, but I did have this I'll tell you the story about this boy that tried to sock me in my face. He was a big kid. He was at this ninth grade school in Newark. And I would stand at my door, and he would come in, and you know how you kind of lunge at somebody trying to scare him? Well, he was doing that to me all the time, you know, and I basically ignored him. But one day kids were coming in, and I was behind my desk. And he, you know, came up to my desk while I was sitting down, and he just lunged at me. And, you know, I think I had a little breakdown because I told him, I said, I'm so sick of you lunging at me. I said, you want to hit me, don't you? And he looked at me, and then I cursed him out, and I said, you want to hit me? Hit me. Go for it. And he swung his fist, and it was in slow motion for me because and I'm sitting down. He swung his fist. My hand came up. I blocked his arm. I jerked it down. Then I pulled it up behind his back, and I jerked it hard. And he fell out straight on the floor. And I was still
sitting down. You had to protect yourself. And you know what? I don't blame any teacher for protecting their self.
But I said, it's survival for you. It's when you were him.
Right. What I did next wasn't really protecting myself because once he hit the ground, I lost my mind, and I just jumped up and just started beating the crap out of him. I mean, I didn't sock him in his head, but I socked him all in his body.
You know why? My mother, she told me.
Listen, he curled up on the floor. I'm beating him up. I got tired. We had chalkboards back then. I got tired. I got mad again. I took the eraser. I chalked him up. I said, what do you want to do now? And he goes, I want to go to the bathroom and clean up. And then the kids went crazy. I forgot they were in the room. They jumped up. They ran out the room. They ran down the hallway screaming, Miss Bess just kicked Dwayne's butt. That was crazy. That was crazy.
And they
now,
knew not to mess with Mrs. Bess for that day forward, I bet.
Did he go home and tell his mama the teacher beat him up? I don't think so.
No, not at all he didn't.
But it probably it got around the whole school to where the kids were probably like,
right.
Oh, well, y'all better not mess with her.
Right, right. We don't want Miss Bass.
They didn't mess with me. You know, when I was in Newark also, we had a gang of kids that would go around and walk into a teacher's classroom and just beat the heck out of somebody. You know, if they wanted to do things, they'd go around looking in the room, and they would go in the room, and they would beat the heck out of the kid right in front of the teacher, you know, and so it was lunchtime, and Antoinetta came back to class early, a little early at lunch, you know, and she looked all nervous, and I asked her, I said, Antoinetta, what's wrong? And she said, well, Camila and them are after me, and that was the gang that was going in rooms. And I said, what do you mean they're after you? She said, they're going to be coming where? I said, where are they? She said, they're at your door. I looked up, and I had a sea of children in the hallway getting ready to come into my classroom, a sea of kids. I couldn't see the teacher across the hall. I couldn't see the other teachers. They were at the door. I went to the door, and I cursed them out. I said, I know. You did not come to Miss Best's room trying to do this. You better get your butts out of here. And the kids did an about face and went back down the hallway. And when they got down the hallway, I saw Miss Reed right across the hall. And she was like, girl, I know that's right.
Wowee. Wow.
Right.
And that's crazy in the classroom. That's in your book, isn't it?
Oh my God. Mm-hmm. And so many more crazy stories like that. You know, just
that.
And they asked me, do I want to go back and teach in my retirement? Do I want to go back and substitute? I don't want to walk my foot back into any school as long as I live.
Oh, my
and
goodness.
And it gets worse every year.
It's like a war zone. Oh.
It
sounds like a war zone. Well, I know. I want you to hold that thought because we want to hear even more Crazy in the Classroom book. We also want to know, you have a written screenplay. Let me try to pronounce it. A written screenplay. Is that right, Renee?
Yeah, it's called Black Paradise.
Black Paradise. Well, hold that thought because me and Julie, I know we want to find out more about it. We always have either some type of a break or a station identification. And hold that thought. Julie, what do we have for a song that Billy and TJ would put on if they were on this program? Mm-hmm. You got your list out? Julie? Well, I guess she's not there. But we're going to go up to a fast commercial break, and we'll be right back. Hold that thought, because I want to talk more about Crazy in the Classroom, and I also want to talk about that screenplay. Hold that thought.
Okay, that's great.
All that checking, all that searching for assassin. Hey, I just can't, sorry for the bodyguard. Caribbean radio show, the chat reel, where you get live real chat and the topics are chat reel.
Welcome to the chat reel with Billion Friends. Standing in for Billy Tappin, I introduce Dr. Denise Gotautis and Julie Sepulveda.
Yes, welcome back, everybody. We have Renee Best. And we're sorry, we've had so many technical difficulties, but you know what? Our special guest, she is making up for it. She is a great interviewer and a great retired educator. We are just happy, happy, happy that she has joined Billy and Friends for the, you know, with the chat wheel to do the program. Thanks, everyone. And so, as we were discussing, we're going to continue the discussion. We were talking a little bit about her book, Crazy in the Classroom, but we wanted to talk about this type of screenplay. And excuse my
what do you call it? You could tell I have a little bit of a stuffiness here, but I'm getting over it. Anyway, I hope, Renee, you could hear me okay.
Yeah, yeah.
Because I'm so self-conscious about my little stuffiness going on, because
no,
I've been running
good.
Around, but but I hope you don't notice. Well, anyway, I wanted to ask you, and Julie wanted to ask you more about that screenplay. What is that about?
Okay.
Is it about Crazy in the Classroom? Okay.
No. But I want to say you can get Crazy in the Classroom on Amazon. You don't even need to know my pen name. So, but yeah,
oh, okay.
You can get Crazy in the Classroom on Amazon. No, yeah, I once I retire, well, I was writing before I retire, but I have a synopsis here I can read you about the screenplay, and then, you know, we
okay.
could talk more about it. All right. Nikki
All
is
right.
a Nikki is a paramilitary trained young black woman who lives in an exclusive, economically independent black community created by her mother, called Black Paradise. It is governed by women, and the men are their enforcers. Nikki has been groomed to take her mother's place as leader. When Nikki's mother is assassinated by a vicious street gang for encroaching on their territory, Nikki channels all her paramilitary skills and training to avenging her mother's death. Nikki believes in order to preserve her mother's legacy, she must act alone in hunting down the killers. She is afraid if the enforcers get involved, they will start an all-out war, destroying her mother's legacy. Nikki has a deadline to get it done, and if she can't, the enforcers will have their time.
Wow. Awesome. And, you know, it's more of a screenplay. Now, have you put this, are you actively going forward with it to put it in front of, oh, go ahead, to put
I've
it in front of people so they could produce them? Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah, there's a film festival, a website, where you can go on and enter it into different contests. And I did enter it in the Black Feedback competition, and actually they read it and they give you a critique on it. And they thought it was really good. They thought my descriptions of the scenery was good and the action. You know, they said I wrote that well. So what I'm doing now is I'm kind of gathering up different producers, Black male and female producer, director, writers, and I'm going to be sending it out to them. But I don't have an agent.
Oh.
No, you need an agent for this kind of stuff. So I just basically have it done. Mm-hmm.
You know what? You also need to, like, probably, get it. Well, I'm sure you got it copyright protected.
Oh, of course. And it's registered with the...
Yeah.
Writers Guild, you know.
Awesome. Yeah, because
it's ready to go out.
You know,
it's copyrighted.
I know that it's going to do good. That sounded. I mean,
everybody,
the part you read was wow.
Everybody who reads it is like, whoa! They're like just so blown away, you know, about it. My brother was like, you know, if you don't write a sequel to this, I'm going to kill you. So, but yeah, the idea. You know, Nikki is the hero. But,
yeah,
you know, I wanted to kind of make a statement, a political and social statement with that movie, because it is
sure.
an economically independent community created by women who are the decision makers,
mm-hmm.
and the men are only enforcers. That's it. And they have political
mm-hmm.
power. They have a strong voting base. The community is exclusive. They have their own economic system going on within their community. They depend on themselves. So it's kind of a social message and kind of a thing that says, hey, look, we can be more economically, politically, and socially independent if we really want to, because we spend billions of dollars. We're just not unified.
Yes.
So I wrote a movie about, you know, and it's kind of like a Black Wall Street kind of concept. You know, but in order to write a good movie, you got to have a lot of action in it and stuff. And Nikki's the hero. and she's a badass, and she takes care of business, and she does it by herself.
Yeah, I have a cousin. He's a producer in Hollywood, and he does screenplays and screenwrites as well as producing music as well. They are in need of people to write, do screenwriting in Hollywood and everything to submit, it to the studios because they love different ideas like that. I mean, because what you have there is really awesome. It's awesome. That's an awesome screenplay.
Well,
I'm sorry,
Julie,
did you say something?
No, I didn't. I was just listening. Taking notes. I had put one of the books into a screenplay, so I was just curious what you had did. So.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I kind of believe they're looking for good screenplays out there. I kind of believe that. You know, it's a matter of getting it in the right hands, and really it's a matter of who you know. You know,
exactly.
I'm trying to figure out who knows who.
Yeah.
Somebody have a cousin that's a friend who has a neighbor that, might be able to get me in the door.
Yeah.
A lot of it, go ahead.
Oh, no, you go ahead. I was listening.
I was just saying the fact that violent, what makes it vibrant is that, things are based on a true story. You have to add some fiction into it to attract it. And if you've got a good mind for fiction, which you obviously do, you can be creative and people are attracted to it. A little bit of truth in it and some fiction added to it. That's exactly what big screenwriters in Hollywood want.
Well, you know what? That's exactly what I did. A lot of that movie is about my life. You know, my mother being killed. That's true. Me growing up as a Republic of New African, which was a much more militant, radical group than the Black Panthers in the 70s.
Wow.
So a lot of that, that came from, that movie was inspired by my life and my desire to revenge my mother's murder, which was a contract hit by the Black Mafia family in Detroit. So the movie was kind of the movie was based on me, getting revenge from my mother's death.
Right.
So basically I'm Nikki in the movie, but I kind of embellished it and, made it a Black community, kind of a Wall Street kind of thing where we see Black people, in Black paradise, there are schools and churches and stores and, everybody has a job and it's just economically sufficient. And they're very, and in the movie, I made them very powerful politically. They had a strong voting base, and they went to city council and told them what they wanted, and they got what they wanted. And that's just from having a strong voter base. So I'm making a lot of statements in that movie about things I think we need to do as people, Black people.
Yeah, and it's, as you get the fans and the role models, and, you're a role model, to get the Black community when they read your material to think in the proper way instead of thinking in a way that they never could be. Because what really got me in, what you're doing is so important for Black people have always looked, we've always looked at ourselves. It always been that stereotypical thing in the world. Hey, you're Black, that's bad. Or it's the less attractive, or it's the, the less financially stable, the less, the lesser of things. In this book, and I see what you're doing, it's putting a positive light, don't ever believe you can't do this, you can do this, even if it's put in a book in a way that, is fiction and, or nonfiction, fiction, whatever category it lays in, but what I mean. It's something that's something that's needed because everybody, we were discussing, Julie, too, on the earlier program, how everybody was in an uproar about the Little Mermaid. She was, always seen as white Ariel, a beautiful white Ariel mermaid with red hair, but they decided to make her a black mermaid, you know, and everybody was in an uproar about it. But what people fail to understand is that the black community do need positive role models in, like you, Renee, to, you know, bring about a positive thought, you know, process in order to get better and to heal, you know, it, to bring about. I mean, Black Wall Street was awesome, but the sad thing about Black Wall Street is that people grew jealous and ripped Black Wall Street apart. And
that's why in my movie Black Paradise, they have their own military force, which are the men.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so
right.
In my Black Paradise, that would never happen, what happened to Wall Street. You know, that's not going to happen because, you know, everybody.
Yeah, they have it reinforced. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's right.
So, this is awesome. And more people need to, you know, movies. It's nothing wrong, you know, with putting, you know, black actors, which, you know, in a positive light. I remember growing up, though. I remember seeing the negative light, too, and I'm sure everybody else. They used to always stereotypically put blacks in movies and plays. They were either pimps or prostitutes. That's what I remember. In movies, you know, and that's terrible. Mm-hmm. And Renee, this is a good thing.
It was so sweet. I did a TikTok on the little black girls, their reactions when they saw that the mermaid was a black girl. And it just made me cry, you know, because they were just so surprised, and they were like, wow, she's a black girl, you know, and they were just so happy, you know, to see themselves represented in the mermaid, you know, that famous thing. But girl, a lot of white folks was big mad about that, big mad. How could you turn a little mermaid into a little black girl? You know, they were just, that racism just rose its ugly head, boy.
Yeah, it did. And you know what? I don't understand why. I mean, you know, the Ariel, the white Ariel with the red hair, white little girls are able to look up to her and Cinderella and say, look, a beautiful white role model of a white little girl, and she just feels so beautiful. She could look in the mirror and, you know, groom her hair. I think black girls should have that same right to do that, to look at a black Disney character and just do their little hair and think they're the most beautiful queens and princesses in the whole world. I mean, nothing is wrong with that, with putting a positive reinforcement up for children. I mean, this, you know, this should happen for Mexican little girls. This should happen for Chinese little girls. You know, it should happen for Indian little girls. I mean, but you know what? It always comes up when it happens for black little girls. Everybody want to gang up. Oh, well, my goodness. Look, we can't have that. But no, this is something that needs to change, and I think that positive change is coming about through you too, Renee. It is. It is. Through writers like you who try to put a, you know, try to, the people who are not even represented are underrepresented, you know. What do you think, Julie, about it? I mean, it's just.
I agree. For some reason, you know, we've got this thing broken in our head and since basically conception that, you know, blue eyes are beautiful and blonde hair is beautiful and red hair is beautiful. So that's the first thing we think about when they think about princesses. It's got to be a little blonde hair, blue eyed girl, you know.
Everybody's beautiful. Yeah. And what is your thoughts on it, Renee? We're talking it.
I'm a TikTok creator. I have about 23,500 followers now. And and my page is for women, but it's for women of all color. You know, and sometimes I get my sisters on there, my black and white sisters on there, and they, you know, they want to argue. And I put a stop to that immediately. Like, my page doesn't even give the tone that you can do that, you know. And I don't allow my black and white sisters to get into it, because what I told them essentially is we're women and we're nurturers, you know, and we need to get past the pettiness of color, okay, because that's so petty. So, I mean, I have white women, black women, all women of all color, you know, because I love all women. And I think we have to go beyond color. And it's not black people that
that's
look
right.
at color and make it a crime. You know, it's just this country that we live in. And we've been here, I don't know, 500-600 years. And a lot of things still haven't changed for us. And I think as a people, we've kind of lost that whole civil rights drive that I grew up in, being born in the 50s. You know, we're not doing
right.
it anymore. Everybody's just off doing their own thing. And as a people,
that's
we
right.
have to remember our struggle is not over. And when I teach in these schools that are battlegrounds and in these communities where, you know, it's dangerous, you know, as black people, we need to wake up and do more for ourselves. You know, if we don't
yes.
wake up and do more for ourselves, we're going to stay in the same situation. You know, and that includes voting and buying black and sending your kids
yep.
to be educated. And just like they were in the 50s, you know, those black folks back then, you didn't play. The teacher called home, you got a butt beaten. You didn't have my many
oh,
times
yeah.
I called parent, my parent, the parent would say, well, let me wait till my kid comes home and I want to see what they got to say. My mama said, I don't have nothing to say. You know, and we respected education back then, but with all the drugs and guns and with the workforce offshore now and no factory bases here, getting bad. It's getting bad, and we need to wake up as black people and start doing, you know, some of the right things. You know, we got too many of these kids on the street robbing and selling drugs, and that, I mean, my God, Martin Luther King would roll over in his grave if he could see the young people, you know, today. But like
that's
I said,
true.
It's not their fault. It's not their fault that the guns and the drugs have been put in our neighborhood, but it's our fault when we
right.
use them.
Right.
You know, it's
it
our
is.
Fault when we need to
it,
a it's little
the direction.
More.
It's the stereotype thing, though. I think that that's the root of it. How do little black girls and black boys, how do they view themselves in society as a whole when they look at somebody that's the same color and they look at them and they see mostly negative images rather than those positive images? How does it impact them? And what you're speaking, it, you know, what you're speaking is the truth. I mean, it's the, you know, the influence. And
I think as parents, we have to do it as parents to help our kids. I don't care what kind of environment you live in. When your child comes into your home, that's where you raise them and train them and teach them. You know, and I think the parents are dropping the ball in these big cities. You know, they're dropping the ball, and it's sad. You know, I'm not your enemy. I'm your child's teacher. I have knowledge to impart to this child, and you want to fight me. You know, you want to beat
right.
me up. You want to come to school. You want to holler at me because I'm hollering at your kids. But, you know, there was a lady on TikTok, and she did a little TikTok. She thought it was funny. Her kids weren't listening. You know, kids were doing something, and all of a sudden she just screams, UMF. Better go set your BA set down. And then she says, I don't know why these kids make me talk to them like that. And I hit her back. I said, you know, you have to scream and curse at your kid to do something. And then you send them to school. And when I curse at them and scream at them to do something, you want to get mad about it. But that's how
right.
you train your child. And she hits me back with all these question marks. I said, it's not hard, lady. If your kids don't respond unless you scream and curse at them, how do you think they're going to respond to a teacher? Would you please sit down, children? It's time to start. No, they're not going to sit down until I scream. You better set your ass now. Right.
And
right.
I had to do and I had to do that a lot in those inner city schools. I had to go in there and tell them, sit your ass down.
The only way that they responded.
But that's what they responded to. I was in the store. There was a black lady in there with a baby. He wasn't even 2 years old. Get your MFA over here now. And I wanted I wanted to say something to her so bad, but I said, Renee, if you say something to this lady, you're going to have to fire her. So I said, I'm not telling
anybody.
Hey, I do
want to mention that we do need to go to a commercial break real quick here. So I don't have the list in front of me right this time, but we do have it. We just want to make a quick little announcement and do a little advertising. So we are going to take a quick little commercial break, and we'll get right back with you.
Okay. We'll be right back.
From author Dr. Denise Gotatis comes a self-help guide that will give you valuable information about the world around you in ways never imagined. The Metaphysical God in Relation to His Creation, available on Amazon. In this must-read book, you will learn about your importance in the world and the metaphysical universe around you. You will be introduced to the Metaphysical God who has a relationship with you and those around you. Whether you are aware of this or not, you come into contact with Him daily. He is omnipresent metaphysically. He is in and outside of His creation. And what does a metaphysical God have to do with you and the creation around you? You are a very big piece of a huge puzzle. The Metaphysical God in Relation to His Creator, from author Dr. Denise Gotatis, is available on Amazon. Order your copy right now.
The creative device literally stops the ball. It creates a field for you that you stream.
We're actually back. We're standing in for Billy Tappan here on the chat reel. Me and Julie Sepulveda and me, Dr. Denise Gonzalez, we're here talking with Renee, and she is Renee Best. She is giving us a tour and a experience, a taste of her experience, not a tour of her experience, a taste of her experience while she was being an educator in Oakland, California, Michigan, Newark, and New Jersey. And we're here with her just chit-chatting with her and talking, and we're learning a lot from each other. And Renee, I wanted to ask you, this is off topic a little bit, but you're an influencer. You have like around, you said 23,000 followers on TikTok. I wanted to get your opinion as an influencer, some of the things that Kanye West talked about. How do you feel about it? You know, you don't have to answer if you don't want to, but that's a big topic going around about that. What do you think of that situation?
What's going on with him?
Oh, now Kanye West, he had come out with a lot of statements. It was a lot of things he said that was anti-Semitic.
Oh, like slavery was voluntary. How slavery was voluntary.
What do you think?
All I know is if he had a black wife, he would have never said that stupid stuff out of his mouth. That's all I know. He's ignorant. Something's wrong with him.
Right.
And like I said, if he had a black wife,
yeah,
he wouldn't have been talking all that stupid stuff. Slaves wanted to be slaves. They had a choice.
Right.
They could have walked away and got killed.
Yeah.
I was a history teacher, and I'm just mad because this boy missed American history class.
Right.
He sure did. did. He said a lot of out there things, you know, because a lot of times when I'm looking at him, even before, you know, he even said statements like this, something just wasn't right about him. Like you could tell he's not mentally there somehow.
And in touch with reality.
Yeah.
Well, when he was saying all that dumb stuff when Trump was running, Snoop Dogg said him and the boys were going to get together and sit Kanye down and have a talk with him. Now, whether that happened
or not,
that's
what they
sure
did.
Yeah.
So
oh,
I don't
my
know
goodness.
If that happened or not. But you know what? The problem is we got a lot of ignorant people in our race. We got Herschel Walker running.
Oh, he's terrible. He is terrible.
Oh, my God. I was so embarrassed. He's so illiterate.
Poor
he can't talk. His grammar is terrible. I was
exactly,
just embarrassed.
Exactly.
So I'm like, here we go with the token Uncle Tom. Everybody knows
right,
that.
Right, right,
he's just a token. That's all.
We got a black person in there. Now we've met the quota. Yeah.
Well,
exactly, but it's the black person that the white folks want, you know.
Well, see, at the same time,
right?
I know that, you know. I kind of think that, I don't know. I kind of think me myself. I could just say that for me personally, with these politicians, with even Obama. And Trump, I didn't trust any of the politicians because I see something wrong with both sides of them. At one time, you know, because at one time, people would think, I've seen it, you know, like I would say, for example, in Israel, there's a lot of black people in Israel, and they wanted Obama to come over and stop by and help them with some of the political issues that were going on there. And he snubbed them. And then I noticed the, what do you call it, in the Chicago area, a lot of the barbers were asking him for help. He snubbed them. And, you know, all of the promises, some of the promises that he made, a lot of those guys got mad at him. And so
well, you know,
a lot of them...
You know, he doesn't, I think Obama did as much as he could that he was allowed to do. You know, we have to understand, we don't live in a real democracy.
Right, I totally agree with you on that. We were just talking about that. It was like, okay, we've given you your black president, but we're keeping on a really short leash. You know, so a lot of the things that he did because he could do. You know, he wasn't allowed to do a lot for his people because, like I said,
yeah.
I think they just, okay, we gave you your black president, you know. They kept it on a very short leash.
You know, and still
yeah.
be ethical.
I think, but
you
know what?
Be a Donald Trump
I kind of think
if you don't want to be ethical.
Yeah. You know
but
what? Though
problem,
I think that all of them is kept on a leash because it looked like a script to me.
Well, here's the problem because I also taught civics for a number of years, government, United States government, and here's the
right.
thing: we don't really live in a democracy at all. We have an elitist government. And I'll give you one little tiny fact that proves we have an elitist government. If you don't have money, you're not going to win any elections. You have to have money to even win an election. I am getting inundated with all these texts for me to be a grassroots person and contribute to all these different, some of our candidates. So some of our candidates
right.
get their money from the grassroots. But most of these candidates get their money from big companies. But if you don't have the money, you're not going to win any elections in America because you need money for TV, you need money for campaigning, you need money for traveling around. So if you're a poor person, forget it. You'll never be in the United States government. And that's not right.
No,
right.
No.
Wow. That's true. That's true. The money makes a difference in every government. I could because they're not interested in you if you are not a billionaire or a millionaire. They really aren't interested in you or close to it. So yes, that's very
that's
true.
That's why it's important for grassroots people to donate. I mean, even if I donate $5, $3, $15,
uh-huh.
and I'm getting like 15, 20 texts a day because they give your email out to everybody and everybody's, you know, begging for money because you have to have money to be a public official in the United States. No poor person
is going to get to be the president or any other official because you don't have the money to run the campaign.
And that's the main reason why they say the American dream is a myth.
It is. And with enough money, you can buy an election. Trump is too for that.
Oh, yeah. That's what I'm saying. You know, people don't even know you, but you can come out and get that money and get your little campaign going. And Trump won because he had the money behind him.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Trump
he
days
did.
Are over, though.
He
we
did, and then there was some prickly stuff with that ballot boxes. I was like, woo, I was watching. Man, it's like you're watching a drama on TV. And, you
I'm
know, they have that...
I'm watching the debate, and they're actually asking, if you lose, will you bow down, you know, if you lose, will you give up easily? I mean, well, I'm like, what kind of question is that we're asking our political, if you lose, will you accept the fact that you lost? What kind of stuff is that, girl? These Republicans and Democrats are acting like they're enemies. When Nixon did something wrong, the Republicans didn't rally behind him. I mean, this is almost like a civil war, you know, between Democrats and Republicans.
That's what got me because it was the divisions that was caused. I mean, when you look at the whole picture. Before, when Obama came in, I noticed that a lot of the people that were racist, you could see them. And then when Trump came in, because it caused that rift, it caused that division. And then when Trump came in, you see the other half of the black people, you know, it caused a rift that I have never seen before in the country because people before that, you know, even before the towers, everything, racism and prejudice where I was from, it was looked down on. People they were beginning not to care at first about people's color after Dr. King. You know, it seemed like, you know, my generation, it seemed like people were caring less about your skin color, where I was from, California anyway. But I noticed after Obama got in office, that's when people started, you seeing the racists come out of the woodworks. And you see, when Trump got in, you could see the other half of it. Oh, I'm sorry, what was that, Hume?
Yeah, I was just agreeing with you exactly.
Yeah, because I can't remember a time when people were just so, you know, divided. Even, you know, don't you remember? I mean, Sanford and Son, it used to be so funny. Even Archie Bunker, you know, even though nobody liked him, you know, he was a racist, prejudiced man. But we used to sit and watch those sitcoms. Nobody got offended. Nobody really cared. And Carol O'Connor, the actor in real life, when he comes and he meets a person, he wasn't racist. He was just a man who loved everybody. And so people, you know, I'm noticing that it was like a change, like something dark came over, you know, the country, and everybody's head just got so twisted and turned around that where
you know
everybody... is so obsessed with skin color now, you can't see straight. And I'm sorry, go ahead.
Well, I believe they were always there. These racists were always there, and it was unpopular to be a racist. And then Donald Trump gets into office, and he gives everybody permission to come out the woodwork and be racist. So to me, Donald Trump kind of turned us back so many years by allowing, you know, racism to be okay. That's basically what he did.
I know, but at the same time, some people see that same thing with Obama. And that was when I noticed the turning point. And because it had never been, I guess they say it never been a black president before Obama, which, hey, we interview
Sophia Stewart, that the creator of The Matrix and The Terminator, and she said, oh, no, you Google, there has been seven black presidents. And I'm like, oh, I didn't know this. And so I'm Googling and I'm looking and I'm like, what? Because, you know, she started naming them off, but I'm like, you know, I don't know what the trigger was, but, yeah, I noticed, of course, we knew that in the South there were always, you know, racist, you know, KKK. But when Obama came in, it triggered that half of the people. And then when Trump came in, the ones who were really, you know, the militant blacks came out too. And so it's like two groups, you know what I'm saying? And you can see that it's like a divide. It never been like that before because people hid that. They were ashamed of it. And to this day and age, Renee, I mean, I think they still should be ashamed of it. But nowadays, nobody, when all of that came out, everybody else is, you know, going against, I'm just going to say the Torah, the Bible, everybody else, you know, they start coming out too. I'm just noticing this. This is an observation.
Right.
Yeah.
Here's attention. But the thing is, you know, go ahead.
Mm-hmm. Oh, go. Just people who used to be ashamed, they ain't ashamed no more, and they know they wrong.
No.
No. Well, you know, they don't know they're wrong. They don't
know
they're wrong.
They,
I mean, this is what they truly believe in their heart, you know, that they are superior and, you know, other people are inferior. But to me, that's a sign of your inferiority right there, thinking you're better than somebody else.
Just pure ignorance. You know, we want some purebreds up there. Nobody's pure anymore. Nobody is. You know, so like, we want the purebred to continue. What exactly is that now? You know, everybody's mixed with everything. You know, I don't care if you're a different type of European. Nobody's 100% German. Nobody's 100% African-American. Nobody's pure anymore. And then that's what they're usually, their goal is, at least with the Aryan Brotherhood. They want a pure nation again.
And that's odd because, yeah, that's the truth, Julie. Because you know what? I seen family, they went like 2-3 generations back. Or 4 generations back or whatever, I seen this article on this family. They were a white family, and their ancestors were actually black. They came off of the slave ships generations back. Just like you can see the opposite with the total black family, they go generations black. For instance, my mother, for instance, generations back, her great-grandfather, he do look like a Caucasian man. And I seen the same with white families. They go generations back. Their families are black. America is just so mixed up that racism shouldn't even exist here anymore. I've seen it.
Well, you know, as long as white people stay in power, it will exist. And they're very afraid right now. You know, they are petrified. When we get these old white men out of government, we'll get a new generation of white people. But right now, you know, they're holding on for dear life. And this just reminds me of the Civil War so much and why the country went to war during the Civil War. You know, these two different factions, you know, that are totally different. And you still have the white people that want black people to have equal rights, and you still got the white people that want to keep us down. You know, but this whole thing with Roe versus Wade, you know, with them, I mean, not the abortion one. Well, you
that
know, 60% of the abortions are by white women. So you have to ask yourself, why did they do this? They did this because they know that the white population is dwindling, and with all this immigration and all these black folks, that in 20 or 30 years, you know, when these old white men are out of power, this country's going to change, and they know that. They know this.
It's a demographic threat. Okay.
Because that
I get
means
it.
They
but yeah, I've heard
power.
That before, that the demographics are going to change because the country is inviting to so many immigrants that the blacks are no longer going to be a minority, you know, a minority,
and that's why
the people of color.
Immigrants. they demonize immigrants. You know, all the immigrants come over, bring drugs and rape and kill people. You know, they demonize
them. Right.
They demonize anybody who they feel, you know, could come in and take some political power, because these are
right.
people of color that are immigrating here. People from France and Europe, they're not trying to come here. You know why?
Yeah.
So we're getting a lot
yeah.
of immigrants, a lot of people of color in this country. We're getting a lot of people of color in the government, a lot of grassroots people in the government, and they're scared to death because they know eventually our government is going to be people of color.
Now, I wanted to ask you as well, the people, the African Americans that are seeking citizenship in Ghana, have you heard of that initiative, and what do you think of that?
I haven't heard about that.
Okay, because I've noticed, well, me going overseas, because I just came back from Israel, like, over a week and a half ago.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and I've noticed that a lot of the African Americans, a lot of African Americans are re-immigrating over to Africa and starting their businesses over there because Ghana has given an invitation for African Americans and an apology to African Americans that if they would like to immigrate, apology for the slave trade and apology, and they said that they would give land and they were inviting African Americans to come back over and immigrate over there and start their lives over again and help the country. And I noticed that this initiative, it kind of faded and went back in the woodworks. Because after COVID came out, they started requiring that people take the COVID shot and everything. And so the rush to get from one place to another, it kind of decreased and everything. But yes, there was an initiative for African Americans to get free citizenship to certain countries in Africa. I think Sierra Leone and Nigeria was one, but I've seen Russia, many African Americans, they were going back to Africa to live, to work in everything. And now everybody is trying to say that Africa is diverse because the Chinese come and they gave them a loan for development and all of this other stuff. And now they have the African Union. I don't know if you heard of this. I
mean, I love that.
Yes.
I heard something about that even years ago. But I think it's wonderful.
Yes.
I think if any African-American here would like to go back home to our mother country, I think it's wonderful. And if they're doing things to help us come back, hey, I love it. I love it. Some will go back, you know, but most probably will stay here. But I think
yeah.
it's a wonderful
I've heard it's, of a – it's been a flood of people in – I don't think that the United States wanted to lose too many people in a way, they'll make it to where they will stop a flood of people from leaving. But at the same time, you want
to
leave, but at the same time.
Denise, you're trying to say they're trying to stop black people from leaving? That's hard to believe.
Right, exactly.
Hard to believe. Well, you kind of get the sense, want to stop you from leaving, want to hate you here, but want to stop you from leaving. People
right.
need, you know, right. you to work for them. You know what I mean? In that sense.
Mm-hmm.
They don't need us anymore. The manufacturing bases are gone. That's why you have all this poverty in these big cities. These big automobile
right.
companies are gone
well,
now. They put drugs in our neighborhood. They put guns in our neighborhood, and then they took our jobs, and, honey, that is
right.
a formula for disaster.
Right, right. Ironically,
yeah.
talking
with
about
me.
No,
oh, what was that?
I just want to make a point that the interesting part that when Trump was president and you know, he wanted to build this wall up to block the Mexicans or the people south of the border from coming in, there are a lot of people, you know, there are a lot of mixed views on that. You know, it was like it's strictly because they're coming over here, they're selling drugs, they're bringing the drugs into the country, they're coming over here taking our jobs. But when he did that block, you know, and it's a population control in the United States, what he did not do was stop the Europeans from coming in. When that was going on, the census was we're going to stop the Mexicans. You also blocked people from Africa from being able to immigrate over here. You stopped people from Mexico from being able to immigrate over here. However, if you were from the Netherlands, if you were from France, if you were from England, they didn't block those people.
Ukraine.
You know, so it's just kind of interesting. Right, exactly. They could still come over here, you know. There was never a complete total ban of people coming to the country. It was people with skin color. And I'm not just talking about Africans. You know, they want the Mexicans. They want the Africans.
The Haitians.
They did allow, the Chinese could still come. The French could still come. And then ironically, you know, they got to follow the same process that everybody else has to follow to come into this country. They can't just be jumping the border and coming over here. Well, that was, you know, he said that, but his wife was allowed to get citizenship after 4.5 years. And she got to, you know, he paid enough money and she didn't have to wait for 10 years. During his election, her mother and father, and I forget exactly where she's from, Czechoslovakia or wherever, her parents got citizenship in 2.5 years. So you say we have to follow the process. That's what you're trying to stop. Wait your 10 years and get your citizenship. Well, yeah, depending on what your skin color is, you know, because certain people still got to come into the country.
Oh, yeah.
No hassle. No hassle at all.
And you know what? That's across the board. Because when I do my program, I'm going to be talking a little bit about that. The issue that we had that, you know,
hey, do you guys,
they don't
do you guys want to hear some of my poetry from my Rack and Black
Adventures?
Yes, please. Let us hear it.
All right. Well, this is one about my brother-in-law. He's an inventor. My name is Thaddeus Exelze, and we're going to have some fun. Inventing the boat stopper is how I begun. I became a jazz artist performing around the globe, strumming my bass. It's easy to hold. My innovative bow stopper enhances distribution. An easy tool to master is my contribution. The creative device literally stops the bow. It creates a feel for using the strings in a row.
Oh, wow. Awesome.
I just had to stop and think about it. Take it all in. That was beautiful. And so true.
It is.
Well, I did that 50 times, so I'm sure I'm a poet after being able to do it 50 times.
Oh, yes, the Poetry in Motion. And your book, it features 50 African-American inventors. Wow.
Yeah, but my book is not out yet. I finished it. And I'm in the process of trying to figure out who I'm going to have publish it. But I want to get it out by February.
Well, you could self-publish it. You know that, too. But
yeah,
you know that, right?
I'm going to self-publish.
If you'd like to get that information, I'll be happy to get it to you. it out there on Amazon so people could see.
Right. Yeah, I have to come back on when my book is done.
Make a quick commercial break, and then we come back. If you could even just give us a little quick preview of, you know, what this book's a little bit about so we can hear a little bit more about it.
Okay, great.
All right. Oh, yeah.
Nice. Like
we
you said, I have the song list right in front of me, so I'm going to let you take over from there. But
Yes, it's Billy. We're Billy and Friends, and we're happy to have Renee Best.
How do it's so hard to live.
And I'll take with me the memory.
That is givebackjamaica@gmail.com.
We're back. I want to thank everybody for joining us. And we are back from that short commercial break with our very special guest, Renee Best. She is discussing her work, her nonfiction book, Crazy in the Classroom, and she's also discussing some of her fine poetry in her screenplay about a black woman who pursues a vicious street gang. I'm thankful, I'm just welcoming of her being here. I'm thankful Renee is here, and we're going to let her take over and say more, teach us more. You can tell she's an educator, right, Julie? She's teaching us.
Yeah, tell us more about it. We're dying to know. We don't want to wait till February. Tell us, if you can, just how it starts out, what happens, and what's the main plot. I mean, we have an idea you're an educator, but it just sounds like there's so much more to it. So.
Yeah. This poetry book, I wrote this because when I was teaching history, that was one of my favorite things to do, to look up inventors for my kids. But I've researched over 200 African-American inventors, and we have invented. I mean, if you were to take everything that we invented, you wouldn't be able to do anything. I mean, from like the pencil sharpener, toilet, to the home security system, to the personal computer by Dr. Mark Dean. He did the personal computer. Food preservatives, things like that, solar cells. And we've created so many scientific things that it's crazy.
Exactly.
Long-distance flying plane. I mean, if it wasn't for Charles Chappell, nobody would be flying too far at all. But he invented the long-distance flying airplane.
Wow.
Yeah. And Right.
You know, the crazy
and
part, those are just documented ones.
The
you know, we can't Google the ones that their slave master took credit for, you know.
Well, I think I think one invention that they did take credit for was the cotton gin. But other than
that's
that,
the first
yeah,
thing I mentioned,
Ed,
they absolutely
things.
Did.
And you,
the car was one as well.
A lot of these inventions were invented in the 1800s.
Yeah.
The mop, 1800s. The mailbox, 1800s. The lunch pail, 1800s. The rolling pin, spark plug, phone transmitter. All these were in the late 1800s.
The streetlight.
So we're an incredible people. I mean, we rise above
yeah.
no matter what, and the inventions that we have is just it's amazing. And then with George Washington Carver, do you know he had 300 inventions from the peanut? 300.
No.
300.
Wow.
300. I'm gonna read you his poem real quick. My name
okay.
is George Washington Carver. My name is George Washington Carver, and we're going to have some fun. I was born in Missouri as the Civil War begun. I studied agriculture at Iowa College as the first black man, later teaching farmers how to rotate their crops to save the land. Peanuts, soybeans, and sweet potatoes enrich depleted soil, using up all the nutrients by the cotton plant so loyal. Paper, stain, and paint, shampoo, soap, and ink, these are only some, just to name a few. Made by me, George Washington Carver. That's who.
Awesome. That is awesome.
Yeah, definitely need to
Oh, yeah.
Renee, what do you do? Wake up in the middle of the night and just something comes into your mind, you write it down, and it all comes together because... You know, that takes especially some time and creativity, you know, and then to make it rhyme or to make it even make sense. What starts your process in writing something like that?
Girl, you got to have a big vocabulary.
That's all I can say. Well, I mean, that's really great. That's great.
That's great.
You know, you got a big vocabulary, you know, I think that helps. That helps a
yes,
lot.
Yes, it
having
does.
A big vocabulary.
It does.
Yeah.
It does.
Right.
Yes, everybody, she is awesome. Renee is awesome.
I've always wondered
that. She's awesome.
You know, and the thing
yeah.
about poetry, right, I say poetry takes so many different forms, too. It takes it in our music. Yes. It takes it in writing the brochure. You know, so poetry encompasses so many aspects of life. You know, it really does. You know, rap music is a form of poetry. To make that rhyme, and, you know, I mean, country music is a form of poetry. Writing a brochure
mm-hmm.
is a form of poetry. It just comes in so many shapes. It doesn't necessarily even have to rhyme.
Right.
That's right. And, you
well,
know.
I've been writing poetry since I was a little girl, and my mom wrote poetry, and my great aunt wrote poetry, so it might kind of just run in the family.
Oh, that's cool. That is so cool.
Yes, it's awesome. It's an awesome gift. I mean, it's a gift of, you know, it's a gift of God. It's
well,
just awesome,
you.
Renee.
Thank
yeah,
you.
Yeah, it is.
You guys make me feel so good. I am
it
so
is,
glad.
It is.
You guys make me feel really good. I got to call you more often.
you're welcome to anytime you want to. Well, I just wanted to say we had just an awesome guest. Renee, you could come on the program anytime you'd
anytime.
Like.
I'd love to have you
to
when
talk
Billy
about,
gets, able to come back, right, because this is, he would be fascinated. And you know Billy, he really is. He is really fascinated by everything that you've done, constantly talking about.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, he was. He was talking
well,
to me and Julie about
Billy.
You.
Well, Billy's a little prejudiced because he's my cousin. So I'm
okay.
Billy's
sure
my cousin, too. So, Renee, we're probably
Billy's
Julie's
cousin, too. I'm still left
Renee,
out here.
Great. Nice to meet you, family.
Oh, yeah, see? It's a small world. It's a small world.
Yeah.
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 Tell my grandson. I will be so excited when I hang up. I got to call my grandson. You're never going to guess who I spoke to. And she's our relative.
It's awesome. But I wanted to say to everyone, and this is what I hate to say, because, you know, the time that we take, it just goes so fast. It goes so fast. But, Renee, I know we didn't cover everything that we were supposed to cover with you.
We covered a whole lot. I think we covered just about everything. We covered a lot.
Are you sure?
Okay.
Okay.
Yeah,
right.
I appreciate I want everybody to buy my book because I think it's important that they educate themselves and they know what our kids are going through. And just to put a kick in the butt for us to do a little bit better in our parenting and let kids know that education is the key to your future.
That's right. And so you could purchase your book. Is it going to be on Amazon or Barnes & Noble, or is it out yet? Are you getting ready to produce?
Well,
are you getting ready to?
The book is done. The book is out. You can get it on Amazon, Crazy in the Classroom.
Okay.
And my other book of poetry should be out by February, and you'll be able to get that on Amazon also.
Awesome.
And
did you hear it? And if they were going to, other than Amazon, is there any other venues that they can go through to order your book or download your books or your poetry or anything about you? Where else can they go find information out about you?
You can order it on Barnes & Noble and everything, but I would just go to Amazon.
Go to Amazon.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, go to Amazon.
Okay. Wow. Awesome.
Well, thank you, ladies, so much.
Oh, yeah.
Thank you for coming.
We thank you so much because we were just blessed by you just coming on and
chatting
with us here on the chat reel. We know that, your cousin Billy, he is just going to be so proud of you because
Denise, tell him to call me because I've been calling him. I'm worried. So if you talk to him, please tell him to call his cousin.
Yeah. And Julie, do you have anything to say pertaining? You guys, if you could chat in between each other, you could probably keep Renee updated, right? Julie, you there? She's probably, if you got a Facebook account, Renee.
I hit Billy up on Facebook.
Okay. Because Julie, are you there? I'm not getting her. Are you there, Julie?
I'm here. Yes.
Okay.
Renee, I just wanted to mention to you that. No,
she
ahead.
Wanted
to
know.
Her that I'm all over her
she
Facebook
wanted to get the continual
up.
Updates on Billy.
I'll talk with you about that privately after the show.
Okay.
Yes. Yes. And if there's some way you guys could connect on Facebook, because I don't have any information. And see, emergencies like this, I would have loved to call you, Renee.
Guys didn't have my phone number, right?
Right. What we can do, though, if you could get in contact, Julie, with Renee after the show, we will do a Facebook. Her name is Julie Sepulveda
Sepulveda. And I did send requests to two of them. Yeah, just probably about a half hour before the show started. So a few seconds to your Facebook Messenger, you'll see some messages from me. Just answer me back, and I'll get right back with you.
Okay, great.
Well, at this time, we have to close. I thank you, Renee, for coming to our program as a guest. You are a special blessing to us, and we will definitely ask you back on But right now, we're going to quietly close with the song that Billy chose for the chat reel. For the closing song is Earth, Wind, and Fire, Keep Your Head to the Sky. Thank you, thank you, Redad.
Thank you so much.
Keep your head and face atmosphere.